Welcome to Reading the Game, the podcast where baseball fans discuss the baseball books they love. In this episode, we're going to be talking about You Gotta Have War by Robert Whiting. And the book's been described as a hilarious, informative, and riveting account of Japanese baseball and the cultural clashes that ensued when Americans play there professionally. I'm delighted to be joined this episode by John McGee from the Bat Flips and Nerds podcast. Hi, John.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And as ever, by Phil Stone. Hey, how's it going, Phil?
It's going well. How are you?
I've actually got a really sore back. I was tidying my six-year-old daughter's bedroom this afternoon, and an insanely hot pain shot through my lower back, and I haven't been able to shift it since. So I'm sitting on a hot water bottle, and I'm feeling a little bit sorry for myself. But I'm just gonna play through the pain like a Japanese pitcher. I'm just gonna play through the pain. Shall we start off?
1,000 ground ball drill.
Yeah. Shall we start off, if it's okay, John, with you telling us how you first came to the book and what your first impressions were?
It's a strange one. This, you sent me that question through a couple of days ago, and I was trying to remember exactly how I found it, and I think it may have just been a book that I found by pure chance. So I am, for people who've listened to our podcast with any degree of regularity, it's a running joke that I sort of go out of my way to find obscure baseball. There's a grain of truth in that. It's not completely true, but I'm a curious person. I like learning about the dark and dusty corners of things that I'm interested in, and I think when I've been into baseball for a few years, I knew there was very good baseball in Japan. I knew nothing about it other than that it was very good and supposedly very different from baseball in the USA. And I think I must just have been looking for, baseball book, books about baseball in Japan, books about baseball in Asia. And this series, there are three books by Robert Whiting that take a sort of roughly chronological look at baseball in Japan, although this one focuses, as you said, more on the experiences of overseas players in Japan. This one, the chrysanthemum and the bat, which is very much about the genesis of baseball and the way of baseball, and a book called The Meaning of Ichiro, which I think has got a different title these days, which is very much just about Ichiro Suzuki, which I've read also. So yeah, I bought this one and I bought the Ichiro Suzuki one. I think it's just one of those things where I just found it kind of by accident, but it had, hundreds and hundreds of incredibly good reviews on Amazon or whatever, and I gave it a go.
Fantastic. How about you, Phil?
I came to it last year when I think we were talking about it as a possibility to do on the podcast when, we were discussing the books that we could do. So I bought it and read it. I read it over about a week, and then I reread it recently. First impressions were, it's fascinating. It's clearly very thoroughly researched, and it covers about 100 years of Japanese baseball in 300 pages. So there's not a single moment to relax. You can't, it's not something where you can take your eye off the ball like I did a couple of times and then just realize that I dusted off 5 pages without actually absorbing anything. So I kind of had to go back. There's a lot of information in it. And then the other thing I found quite interesting about it is it's not really chronological. It kind of dips in and out of decades, and its chapters are centered on loose themes, or a team, or in one case, there's a chapter dedicated to Little League baseball and a junior high school championship. So it's sort of Tolkien-esque in the fact that it took a certain level of like mad genius to get some sort of structure out of so much content and then not do it in a chronological, and this happened in the 40s and this happened in the 50s and this happened in the 60s kind of way. I think the other impression I got is that it's definitely of its time, and the edition that I've got, I think was published in 1990, so a year after it first hit the shelves in hardback. And I think there's been a new updated or expanded edition in 2009, which I haven't read. But there are some phrases or opinions that don't age well. And I suppose the only other thing that I think maybe it lacked for me was the reverse racism. So the book focuses a lot on how American players were treated in Japan, but I kind of wanted to know a little bit more about how the American players who played in Japan treated the Japanese. But I don't know, perhaps that is covered in like John was saying, in the other two books that he's written.
It isn't in certainly in the one that I've read. Just to pick up on a couple of points you made about, but the structure is absolutely extraordinary, isn't it? It's sort of, it reminds me, there is a degree. When Steve, when you sent the questions over the weekend, you were saying that you wanted to talk about how the book is written and the structure of it. It kind of reminds me, and this is going to go highbrow very early on. It reminds me of like a sort of a magic realist book. Its essence is there from the absolute start. Like it introduces this idea of Bob Horner, this incredible, you know, all-star player going over there, and immediately it looks like it's going to be okay, and it kind of all falls apart. And that's kind of the theme that's continually unpacked throughout the course of the book. And the more that you understand about the Japanese way of life and their engagement with baseball, the more you seem to understand why these overseas players who they have to bring in, they're sort of like a means to an end. They absolutely are just a necessary inconvenience. That is sort of the theme of the book, that these guys that they bring in there, that they really would rather that they weren't there. They dirty the way of that they're playing baseball. And the more that you read about how the game is venerated there, the Koshin tournament that you talked about, the more you understand that it's sort of second only to religion in the country. And I think that theme's built up really, really cleverly over the course of the narrative. So yeah, and it did. So I wouldn't say I was a sort of a Japanophile, but I've read quite a lot of Japanese fiction, and it has that same, that's a sort of sparse density. Like there's loads. It's really easy to read, but there's loads of detail, and if you miss some of the detail, that can be really important later on. And I think for an American author to capture that spirit that you would have in like a Mishima book or a Murakami book, I just thought was like an absolute feat of a genius almost, actually. And it's funny, like the last time that I was on the podcast, we spoke about another book that I think has quite a lot in common with it, which is Bottom of the 33rd, which again, I think it's got a certain essence and a delicacy about the narrative. And I think that's here in this as well. But interesting point that you make about the racism. I think it's latent. I think it's there very much, but I think that he doesn't shy away from the disrespect that some of the Americans have towards the Japanese system, and that they sort of cock a snook towards the way they play baseball and view them as stupid. So, you know, I saw that, and, you know, very much I saw it in both directions. You know, am I right in picking up what you're saying there, Phil, that there's a sort of a racism towards the gaijin, that they're this necessary evil, really? But I felt that, I felt that those two forces cancelled one another out, because I think they were equally ignorant to one another, frankly.
I definitely feel like Whiting, I mean, you get the impression, like you said, he's spent a lot of time in Japan. He has a kind of expat scorn for the Americans' attitude towards the Japanese. You know, he's very knowing and kind of ridicules it slightly in his description of the way that they behave towards the Japanese. At the same time, I think you get the impression that he loves Japan and he loves that the kind of Japanese culture, but he's not above seeing quite a funny side of the way that the Japanese treat the Americans as well. So it's very dry, but I do think there's a humor in it. And I do think that, comes across. And
he's not above being cutting towards elements of Japanese culture
that
he finds ridiculous. Like, I think particularly the sort of sheep-like culture of the salaryman and you know, the fact that they all sit in the same place and they all do the cheer songs. He's a little bit snarky about things like that, which is often like when we hear about Japanese culture, work culture, or fan culture. That's usually what's prominent. And although he talks about it a lot, it's not without bite, I don't think. I think there's a lot of bite across the whole book, actually.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you mentioned Murakami and magical realism as well in terms of the structure, because I couldn't help but feel that were this fiction, and to a large extent, you know, in descriptions of what was happening in the 70s and early 80s, it might as well be fiction for us, you know, because we weren't there and we weren't really experiencing it. And the names involved were not familiar to me in the slightest. You know, these were very, with a few exceptions, quite minor US baseball players who were playing their trade out in Japan. So it was almost as if he was casting, you know, a set of characters in a sort of fictionalized history, which was really weird. It was apart from anything else, there's something so otherworldly about the way that he describes Japan as well, that it all kind of felt in my head like I was reading Murakami at times, which was really, really interesting. I'm glad that we've got that parallel. How much did you guys know about Japanese baseball? You already mentioned a bit, John, didn't you, that you kind of get criticized, I don't know, criticized not the right word, probably teased about sort of baseball hipsterism, I suppose you might describe it. How much did you know about Japanese baseball before you read the book?
Being honest, almost nothing, to be frank. I knew very little. I knew that it was second only to the major leagues. I was aware of the major stars from Japan in MLB, you know, the Ichiros, the Hideki Matsuis, Hideo Nomo, and, you know, again, the other thing I often tease for, that my favourite baseball player is Japanese, Koji Uehara. That may have been one of the reasons why I wanted to watch it too, read the book too. So no, very, very little. It was almost all new to me.
I'm similar, really. I didn't know very much at all. I knew about Japanese players in America, and I knew that there was something, I think I've used this word, you know, just use this word, otherworldly, sort of exotic about Japanese players being in the major leagues, because when I first started following baseball, it was the mid 90s, but I didn't know until I read the book that, of course, it was only in the mid 90s that Japanese players were reintroduced to the major leagues. So I don't know. I didn't know very much about Japanese baseball in Japan, but I was kind of interested and had my interest piqued by some Japanese players playing in the majors. What about you, Phil? I imagine you're similar to me.
Yeah, what you guys said. I knew next to nothing about it other than, Matsui Ichiro and Daisuke Matsuzaka was a favourite player of mine. I knew some information about them and their histories, but that was it. Like, I knew nothing about the game in Japan.
And so we've given the book quite a good overview and described, you know, our first impressions of it, what it was like to read it. But one of the things that strikes me, I think, is that Whiting uses baseball as a lens through which he explains wider cultural differences between America and Japan. And it's difficult because when he was writing, I know you mentioned, Phil, that you didn't have the revised edition with the new introduction in the afterword. I've got the 2009 edition, so I've been able to read that. But what it strikes me is that the original book that finished in 1989, the relationships, the relationship between Japan and America in 1989 was vastly different to the one of today. But we'll plow over anyway. I mean, to what extent can we learn about a country's culture through their approach to sport? I mean, and how successful has Whiting been, do you think, in this exercise of bringing Japan and its culture to the eyes and understanding of Americans through baseball? Question. Do you want to go
it's
first?
It's a lofty John? Question. Yeah. I think, like, incredibly well, honestly, because this is not a book about baseball. It's a book about Japanese culture. And it's about how Japanese baseball is a cipher for everything that they think is lofty and right about how people should approach their life, from the amount of effort that they put into practice, the fact that players are very much seen as below the coaches, that they have to bow to the coach, right down to the way that they approach an at-bat, right? The thing about being in an at-bat in baseball is that getting struck out is absolutely the worst thing that you can do. It's all about parity of esteem. It's about the batsman making sure that they don't give something away, not taking risks, and so on and so on. So yeah, I think he really, really captures all of those sort of now what are known as sort of cliches about Japanese life and culture, that deference, that venerance, that quiet. It's all there. It's all there. And it's all in the sort of the balance of the way that they approach things. Perfectionism, but quietly and with a lot of diffidence. It all feels like it's in there for me anyway. And, you know, when you drop Reggie Smith or Warren Cromartie in the middle of that, then, you know, it's sort of a bit like, you know, like a Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau film, dropping one of these massive characters in the middle of that. You know, no wonder that madness ensued to sort of make a cliche.
Should we? I'm glad you sort of mentioned that, because one of the most, and we've already said, haven't we, that the book is, it's not a baseball book. It's a book about Japan, but as much as it is a baseball book, it's a book about American baseball players in Japan, as much as it is about baseball in Japan per se. In the book, there are countless anecdotes, I suppose you'd call them, you know, examples of that culture clash that happens when the Americans go over across the Pacific to play professionally. They're called Gaijin. Do you have a favorite? You've already mentioned Cromartie, Smith. Do either of you have a favorite story from the book? And I'll start with you. I'll start with you, Phil.
So many. There's so many anecdotes. It's tough just to pick one. Like a player like Davey Johnson features in the book, and he bemoaned the fact, like John was talking about, he bemoaned the fact that he was the type of hitter who would get hits on his third or fourth at bat. And given what we know about like pitcher ERAs rising through the like the third and fourth time of the order, he was probably right. But it seemed like every American player really hated that, and I can understand why. That if you go hitless in your first two at bats and you get yanked, it's to an American, that's like a massive insult and really humiliating. Liron and Leon Lee, I liked as characters. They were brothers who played in Japan for about a decade, I think it was. And they mainly spoke about how thankless it was that Liron Lee, in 10 years, he hit 320. He collected about 1,600 hits and hit close to 300 home runs and close to 1,000 RBIs, I think. But to very little fanfare, and his club were almost embarrassed by it. Although he did enjoy some recognition from the fans. And in the book, it mentions that the two brothers did go on and record a record, Baseball Boogie, which reached number 12 in the charts. And if you get a chance to look it up on YouTube, you're in for a treat.
I haven't. I'll have to link it.
Shocking.
I'll have to link it in the show notes.
Please do.
In fact, what I might do is just drop it into this part of the podcast now.
Just change the jingle. To it.
Yeah. That'd be awesome.
But there's another player, one more player. I'm going to choose three. It's Charlie Manuel, who got beamed in the head in a game in early June in the late 70s, and his jaw got broken through in six places. And he was, you know, obviously like severely injured and was discharged 6 weeks later. And a teammate of his, Chris Arnold, said that he really shouldn't have come back so soon. He had no feeling in his mouth because he had no nerve. He had no nerves. He'd eat and food would fall out. He'd drool and not even know it. But because he was a player that had showed great heart and fighting spirit, that fans really accepted him and welcomed him back. Like he was a hero. But that goodwill lasted about a year because the following June, he took a week off to attend his son's graduation, which was a clause that he had put in his contract. And that, but the fact that there was a clause in the contract didn't matter at all to fans and the press, who never really forgave him for it. So I think Charlie Manuel is a microcosm of perhaps the American player's experience.
It reminds me of me with my bad back. It's very, very similar. I think I'd be revered as a hero in Japan when they find out about how much pain I am with recording this podcast. How about you, John?
The Charlie Manuel one, I have to say, was one that stuck in my mind as well. The other guy I thought was really interesting was, it's interesting to me to, when you sort of going through the book and a name pops up that you do know, albeit sort of like, I've heard that name before. Bob Horner, who is very prominent in the first couple of chapters, is one of those. The other one that was sort of popped up and I knew. In the first, having reread this in the last few weeks, was Cleet Boyer, and there was a guy who was very much at the fag end of his career, known as a defence first guy. It's just like, why did they? And he wasn't like, he tried very hard, but he was very, very old. Did the best that he could. Wasn't hit anybody. Seemed to sort of cling on, I think, just because they quite liked the way that he approached things. And that's sort of the weird thing. It's like, it doesn't matter how good you are, as long as you try your absolute best and don't cuss under your breath when the manager pulls you out. So yeah, his story was really, really interesting to me. And the other one was Bump Wills, a guy who was an all-star second baseman who signed for the Hankyu Braves. He was a guy who was brought in with a lot of fanfare, that very much brought in by the GM and the manager. This is the guy who's going to get us all of the hits, take us over the edge. And he was just absolutely awful. And they put him in the farm team and then just basically wouldn't let him leave. They just kept him there. They just kept him on the farm team, wouldn't let him go home. He was desperate to leave. No other players had come because of the way that they were treating this guy. It's ridiculous. And there's so many stories like that throughout the whole book. And, even to this day, when you speak to people about Japanese baseball, it's sort of littered like 50-50 of players who go over there and they manage to get along with it, and players who it just doesn't work out for one reason or another. They don't seem particularly good at scouting intangibles. Certainly they weren't in the 60s and 70s.
But that's a recurring theme, but one that Whiting ties really nicely to wider Japanese culture, I think, in the way that he describes how, at one point where he describes how, premium foreign imports are highly prized in Japan. So this idea that you would pay a ludicrous import tax on something like a Mercedes-Benz or on a fine Scotch whiskey, for example. It's how they serve as an incredible status symbol. So the intense embarrassment of importing a highly prized US import from the major leagues, for them to not turn out well, was just the ultimate loss of face for an organization. So they would do absolutely anything to shield them from that embarrassment. Even if it just meant that they would basically hope that they would disappear, but to send them back to the States would be, the ultimate loss of face.
That's why you did what they did to people like Charlie Manuel.
Absolutely,
like, where they had any pathetic excuse to send them back.
And they'd have to create a scenario whereby it would be the American who was misbehaving, or the American who was doing the wrong thing, rather than them face, the consequences of having to admit that they'd made a mistake in importing them in the first place.
And the Americans were wrong. How dare they want to be at the birth of their own son? That's just preposterous.
Well, the funny thing is, I wonder how much when that happened, if fans and the media in the States would have reacted massively differently to it. Because you still get players now going on paternity leave and fans getting up in arms about it, in 2020, but I'll say 2019 instead. So how much do we think, and this is going to be really difficult, I realize now, Phil, for you to answer, but the book was originally written in 1989. How much do we think's changed in the last 30 years in terms of understanding the cultural differences between the US and Japanese baseball? And we'll try and keep it about as much about baseball as we can, but of course, it's difficult to unpick wider cultural differences between USA and Japan in that time, because a lot's changed in those 30 years. Does anyone, I'll go with you, John, if you want to start us off.
Yeah,
this one.
I think a lot has changed. I don't think you can underestimate the cultural impact that Hideo Nomo and Ichiro have had on bridging that divide. You know, I think from the clubhouse and the fan understanding of Japanese baseball, they've been like, they've just brought it on light years. The fact that, you know, it's a given that everyone knows that Ichiro made the absolute most of his indescribable talent because he worked incredibly hard. You know, his feats on the practice field are legion and legendary. And therefore, it's kind of known, like it's expected if a Japanese player is in the major leagues, you know, the minimum you're going to get is the old Dorioku. I had to look it up. Effort, which is the favorite word of the Japanese baseball player. They're not going to be slumping out of lack of giving it every go. So I think those two guys were just absolutely world changing in terms of understanding of Japanese culture within the American game. Whether there's an understanding of the culture of the league as such, I'm not sure. I think that there's maybe not such a great understanding of the baseball culture at large, if that makes sense, as opposed to, you know, understanding of certain facets of it from the proximity and the cut through of stars like those two and Matsui, I think, particularly.
Maybe I should explain as well that there were no Japanese players in baseball in the States between 1965 and 1995, because there was a working agreement between the leagues, but Nomo kind of broke that through a loophole by kind of officially retiring from baseball in Japan, and then was able to exploit that to become a free agent and sign with the Dodgers in 1995 to massive success. Phil, I'm not going to reword the question because it's incredibly wordy, but are you able to pick up the thread where John left off?
Yes. I don't know. I give me 6 months. The next time we do a book about Japanese baseball, I'll have an answer. I promise. but yeah, my edition ended in 1989, and I haven't watched enough Japanese baseball to be able to confidently answer that question. What does your 2009 edition epilogue say?
Well, I just think it's really interesting because since like John said, so much has happened since 1989. Part of it's to do with baseball and baseball itself and baseball players breaking down those frontiers. But I just think that, you know, international relations between the two countries have been transformed since 1989. You know, the impact of the growth of the Japanese economy and
the end of the globalization,
globalization, the end of the Cold War, you know, all this stuff just kind of had a massive impact. You've just had this perfect storm of circumstances which have made baseball in Japan and America much closer together, if not necessarily in style, then at least in terms of the extent to which players travel between the two leagues now.
And I think increasingly so, right? You know, there's, if you look at the overseas rosters in this year's MPB, it's not just like names, you know, they're like, oh, wow, he is good. Like, you know, Matt Moore maybe hasn't been an elite pitcher for a couple of years, but he's still pretty good. He could still probably be a number five in the majors. You've got Justin Bour, who's hit a lot of home runs, and Adam Jones, who's just like, he's a megastar. Mm. He's going to be playing in Japan this year. So, you know, there is an increasingly porous, it's seen as a not just a sort of a retirement home for major leaguers now, but a viable place for them to go to reboot their career.
And do you get the impression that it's easier now for Americans going to Japan, that culture clash has been kind of diminished by the fact that more and more players are traveling across, and that there's a greater understanding of Japanese culture, maybe more sensitivity on both sides?
I think that's unquestionably true. I mean, that's not to say it's easy, but I think it's almost definitely easier because, you know, there's such a weight of people who have gone before you that if you haven't done your research about what this is going to be like, if you haven't talked to, you know, dozens of other players to get a view as to what you're walking into, then, you know, it's on you, frankly. I think the problem is that, you know, there's still a lot of cliches and there's still a lot of ciphers about Japanese culture, probably many of which have come up in the course of this conversation, sadly. It's difficult to get beyond them. But yeah, I think it probably is. So we had on our podcast a couple of weeks ago, I spoke to Rick van den Herk, who's a Dutch pitcher. He pitches in Japan now, and he went over from Korea, right? So, you know, he found Korea quite difficult to settle into, but even moving from Korea to Japan, he talked about the intensity of that deference and that respect for your elders, respect for the coaches, and how hard they practice was a shock to him, having gone to a baseball culture like Korea, which is not a million miles away. So I do think there's still a huge gap there.
But you mentioned Korea, and I think part of it is that it's a much more trodden path to go, if not to just to Japan, but to Korea or to Taiwan as well. You know, so there's just, it's a more acceptable thing for people to do in the twilight of their careers to head over. We're still yet to see players really going over, as you know, leaving top roles in with US organizations and going over. But
well, it'd be interesting to see how Carter Stewart does, a guy who I spoke to Rick about a couple of weeks ago, who was the number 7 pick in the draft for the Braves and didn't sign with them for various reasons and ended up going and signing for the Hawks for $5 million, which is more than he would have got from the Braves for his number 7 draft slot. So he's a 22-year-old pitcher who's going to be pitching in the minors for the Hawks this year. So he really could set a precedent, particularly with this shortened draft this year, where you've only got 5 rounds in the draft. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised if a few of the top guys who might have been coming lower down might have something lined up over there. It'd be interesting to watch that.
Absolutely. And I think I kind of thought about Eric Thames, or Thames as we call him, and how he was kind of, he'd maybe be something of a pioneer in terms of going over to Asia, being successful and then coming back, you know, that it might be seen as more acceptable to leave if you don't initially make a splash of it in the majors, heading over and thinking that it's not going to be the end of your career if you go to Asia, that you can always come back and be pretty successful on your return. So perhaps he was a bit of a pioneer.
I've listened to a couple of podcasts with Dan Straley, who's pitching in Korea this year, the ex-Marlins and Reds pitcher. And, you know, that's basically what he's doing. He's like, he's probably had a few problems last year. He ended up in AAA, but he felt like he got his delivery back. But he didn't think he was going to get to pitch every fifth day in the majors this year. So he went somewhere where he'd be the number one. And he's got an ERA of about 2.2. So, you know, he'd probably be back in the majors by the time it starts again.
Yeah, absolutely. And someone like Miles Mikolas as well, who's like really successful. So yeah, I mean, apart from anything else, there's a steady flow of very, very successful and talented Asians coming over to play in the majors as well now. So I'm thinking about wrapping up because I've got this timer ticking down telling me that we don't have that much time.
it's stressful, isn't it?
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about the past. I want to talk a little bit about the future. And in the book's epilogue, there's a quote from Laron Lee, who spent a decade playing in Japan, for you've already talked about him a little bit. And he says, the Japanese and American games are running on parallel tracks and they'll never, ever cross. This kind of idea that although similar, they are destined to be dissimilar forever as well. Do you think he's correct? Do you think there'll ever be are we getting ever closer, or are they always destined to be far apart in terms of what they are as products on the field? What do you think, Phil?
When I read that quote, I assumed he was talking about the tactics of the play. So whether or not he was suggesting that Japan will always be focused on small ball, whereas the Major League Baseball is more about power and fastballs. And I think there might be some truth to that. the ballparks, as far as I understand, are still smaller, and generally the tactics is still based around small ball. So I can't see that changing anytime soon.
Yeah, they're still going to send up their two-hole hitter to bunt. They're still going to sacrifice with no outs and one man on. You know, that's not going away. The small ball's not going away. But I think that's a really interesting quote, though. And for me, it's not just about the small ball. It's about the outlook of baseball. You know, in one place, it's a pastime. And in another, it's a way of life, honestly. Yeah. So in the States, it's a pastime. It's part of the fabric of everyday life. But it is not the way of life in the way that it is in Japan. It's just, it seems so imbued in absolutely everything. You know, people, it's a complete cliche, but people eat, sleep and live baseball out there. And it's sort of almost, as I said, you're second to religion, and it just seems to matter more. So the stakes are so high, and it's not that it doesn't matter in the USA. And that for me is the biggest cultural divide that there is. You know, the way that they play the game is different. The way that they practice is different, but the fact that it matters so much more, is what ultimately for me means that they'll if not even on separate tracks, stay on divergent tracks, honestly.
Okay, well, that's a fantastic way to end the recording, I think. Just well done. It's we spoke a little bit off air, didn't we, about how much we all loved this book, but at the same time how we were all kind of, well, I certainly felt slightly apprehensive about talking about it in a way that communicated that affection, because it's difficult to put into words just what it is about the book that makes it so fantastic and such a fantastic read. But I hope that we've done a good job on that front this evening. So the only thing left for me to say is thank you very much to both of you. I've really enjoyed talking about the book. And if you haven't read the book, then you should definitely go read it. Rubbish ending. Sorry, that was a terrible way to end. I'm gonna say goodbye. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye, Steve.